climb down, and leave the room. Outside the conservatory, it had still been early. He took side streets, and if people came up to him or spoke to him, he did not register their presence. After walking several blocks, it dawned on Sparrow that the sound of the city was dulled. 6 trucks, bearing water drums, navigated the narrow lane, but he only became aware of their presence when he caught sight of them. There was a vibration in the pavement, and there were women at a water spigot, and there was a queue for flour, but he moved through them as if through images or projections. He kept walking, and became aware of Ling running towards him, and of Zhu Li in his arms, as if she were sleeping. He had to focus all his mind, all his energy, on keeping her from falling. Her head against his shoulder dug into him. Red guards came and pushed their faces against his face, but he could not hear them. There was a crowd of them, and then, he did not know how or why, he no longer saw them. He came to Beijing Road, to the gate, the narrow laneway and the maze of alleyways he had known nearly all his life. Ling was still beside him, but why had she come? Ba Lut was there. He had seen them somehow, or he had been alerted. It happened so quickly. Ba Lut's approach, Zhu Li taken into Ba Lut's arm, and Sparrow standing by himself in his own home. He knew his father was calling Zhu Li's name. He knew because now he could hear. The room suddenly became very loud. Ling was sobbing. People had gathered in the alleyway, but nobody dared cross into their inner courtyard. It had been so polluted by crimes and spirits. Ba Lut, whose great bulk had turned so thin and old, was crying out, as if he could wake her.
"What mistakes did we make? We're old. We're old now. If I sat down and wrote down all our mistakes, would that be enough? Answer me. What everlasting sins did we commit? Didn't we win this country? Didn't we sacrifice ourselves for the revolution?"
He kept shaking Zhu Li, as if he could drag her back to this place. Sparrow sat down on a chair. He remembered now how the tears on his cousin's face had still been wet. How long did it take for tears to dry? How close had he come to arriving in time? He thought of Wen the Dreamer, and his aunt Swirl, and his mother. He closed his eyes and tried to drown out Ba Lut's voice. Ling reappeared. She put a blanket around him and blocked out the world. He remembered the blanket that had covered him on the bus with Kai, the music that rang out, the constellations above them. He laughed and disregarded his weeping, which sounded as if it came from another person. He laughed and wept until midday came, and with it the true August heat. Chapter 8. Long ago, Ai Ming lay beside me on my bed, holding Chapter 17 from the Book of Records in her hands. The story continued even though she had long stopped reading from its pages. In the quiet, Zhu Li existed between us, older than me, younger than Ai Ming, as real as we were ourselves. Each time we set the notebook down, I had the sensation that she remained. It was we, Ai Ming and I, listening, who vanished. Long ago, when they lived in Beijing, Big Mother Knife had taken Sparrow to Tiananmen Square. Sparrow had only been a child, but he remembered, still, how the concrete felt inextricable from the gray sky, how he himself was impossibly small, like a seed in a bowl. The Forbidden Palace and Tiananmen, Big Mother told him, were built on a north-south axis that mirrored the human body. Head, she shouted, pointing to something he couldn't see. Lungs, feet. Tiananmen Gate, festooned with imaginary animals, was the protective tissue around the heart. North-gazing animals monitored the behavior of citizens, while south-gazing animals judged how power treated the powerless. Sparrow had imagined himself as a stone creature on the gate, wings outstretched, beak glistening in the rain. Day after day, Sparrow read the public newspapers pinned up at the post office. Photos in the People's Daily captured the exhilaration inside Tiananmen Square, as hundreds of thousands of red guards lifted their little red books to Chairman Mao, whose tiny figure waved back from atop the gate. The students arrived by trains, for which they no longer needed tickets. They rushed into the square like water pouring into a single container. 10,000 years! 10,000 years! They shouted under the gaze of those imaginary animals. 100 million years to Chairman Mao! September blared on, wet and sticky. There was a smell in the air, a nauseatingly sweet smell of bodies left to rot in cellars or on the street. When the Shanghai students returned from Beijing, they were even more single-minded than before. For a week, Ba Lut had been locked up in a shed with 6 other faculty from the traditional music department. After his release, he was barely able to stand. A letter from Swirl, sent via Big Mother Knife, arrived. Swirl and Wen the Dreamer, referred to as 2 bags of ribbon, had been safely received in Mongolia. They begged for news. Ba Lut's reply was only 3 sentences. Everyone is fine. No need to hurry back. Long live Chairman Mao and the great proletarian cultural revolution. Every moment, Sparrow expected to be summoned, but the Red Guards never came for him. Everyone seemed to have forgotten he existed. He kept seeing the conservatory, the record, the rope. During the day he tried to sleep, and at night he kept watch over the bed, in which Big Mother, Swirl, Zhu Li, and his brothers had at different times slept. In the gloom, he searched for the outlines of his own hands and feet, but they were camouflaged by the darkness. Night after night he felt as if he was slowly approaching Zhu Li, but when morning came, he saw that he had only slipped further away, and the distance between them was growing. His unfinished symphony played on in his head, unstoppable. All it lacked was the 4th and final movement. But what if the 4th movement was silence itself? Perhaps the symphony was complete after all. Too numb to weep, unable to put words to what he most feared, he bundled the pages up, intending to burn them. But in the end, he hid them under the trusses of the roof. 2 months after Zhu Li's death, Sparrow accompanied Kai to the house of a high-ranking official who lived on Changle Road. On the streets, there was turmoil, warfare between gangs of Red Guards over territory and influence. The official's home, however, seemed a separate country, hushed by walls of scrolls and paintings. The light that fell through the stained glass windows was the impossible blue of sapphires. "We recently recovered this piano," the official said, as he ushered them into a high-ceilinged room, recovered from where or from whom he did not say. "As the instrument is far too valuable to remain here, the party is shipping it to Beijing." A young girl in a flowered dress brought out an overabundance of food and drink. Sparrow gazed at the clean edges of his dinner plate While the official spoke at length about Madame Mao, the new model orchestras, and a reconstructed Central Philharmonic in Beijing. "Comrade Sparrow," the official said, dabbing his lips with a pure white napkin, "your compositions found favor with the president of the conservatory, didn't they? The former president, that is." He smiled in a friendly way.
"He Luting was a bit stuck in his ways, don't you think?
Fortunately, things have changed. Now is the time for new music, a revolutionary realism befitting our great proletarian cultural revolution." Kai said, "Comrade Sparrow's work is a model of what this new music might be." The official nodded. To Sparrow, he said, "You're fortunate to have such an admirer, aren't you?" Above them, the ceiling fan spun, making a sound that was both monotonous and numbing. An array of front gate, Hataman, and State Express 555 cigarettes, as well as foreign brands Sparrow had never seen, were arranged on a celadon platter. He sampled the Davidoff and the Marlboro, and the cigarettes left an unanticipated taste of sweetness or sharpness on his lips. The official motioned Kai to the piano. Kai sat down, thought for a moment, and then played, from memory, a piano transcription of Beethoven's Eroica. The segments he played had been reordered and soldered together in ways that made Sparrow feel as if the music were being composed in this very moment, or, more accurately, being dismantled. "The word Eroica," Sparrow said, turning to the official, "means heroic." The man raised his glass.
"To Comrade Beethoven, our revolutionary brother."
"To our glorious revolution," Sparrow answered. During the slow adumbration of the second movement, the funeral march, the official's eyes ran with tears. How had he never noticed, Sparrow thought tipsily, just how deeply music could lie? The smoothness of all the facades, not only of the apartment, but of everyone in the room, and perhaps Beethoven himself, mesmerized him.
"Conductor Li Delun has asked specifically for you," the official said.
He was speaking to Kai with a calculating look in his eyes.
"He says you're the most gifted pianist at the Shanghai Conservatory. Your class background is exemplary."
The ceiling fan let off squeaking, high-pitched whistles. The sounds made tiny cuts in the air.
"Let the rooms be full of guests,"
the official recited drunkenly.
"And the cups be full of wine. That is what I desire."
After dinner, when the official had dismissed them, Sparrow went with Kai to his room, the same room where they had once met with the professor, the old cat, Sun Li, and Ling.
"There are opportunities, Sparrow," Kai said.
They were lying side by side, only the tips of their fingers touching.
"The conservatory is closed, but the Central Philharmonic is protected by Madame Mao."
"Let them protect us. In Beijing, things will be different."
"Are you writing?"
Sparrow shook his head.
"We can't stop living our lives," Kai said.
The words seemed to disintegrate as soon as they touched the air.
"We can't."
"We," Sparrow thought. "We." He could not even say the word aloud.
"Remember what I told you?" Kai said. "My parents and sisters had no one to turn to. They came from a village that was considered less than nothing. I won't go through that again. I won't disappear. I refuse."
That night, Sparrow was kept awake by a bright seam of light beneath Kai's door. Kai's hand across his stomach was heavy, damp, and he covered it with his own. The things he felt could no longer be disowned, and yet they were not the same. They had come from such different worlds and aspired to different conditions, and the fear that drove Kai did not drive him. Panic welled up in him. He tried to control his breathing to make it quiet. He and his father had not been able to give Zhuli a proper funeral. Prokofiev, at least, had gotten a recording and fake flowers. The authorities had taken Julie's body, while Sparrow and his father stood by. No, they had not stood by. He and his father had praised the chairman, the party, and the nation. They'd had no choice, but still, they had performed disturbingly well, as if words and music were only ever about repetition, as if one could just as easily play Bach as repeat the words of Chairman Mao. Pride and mastery, victory and sorrow, the orchestral language had given Sparrow a deep repertoire of feeling. But scorn, degradation, disgust, loathing, what about those emotions? What composer had written a language for them? What listener cared to hear it? Zhuli was sitting on the edge of the mat, so alive it seemed as if he and Kai were the illusion.
"Haven't you understood yet, Sparrow?" she said.
He asked her what in the world a mere sound could accomplish. She said,
"The only life that matters is in your mind. The only truth is the one that lives invisibly, that waits even after you close the book. Silence, too, is a kind of music. Silence will last."
In the west, in the dry wind of the Gansu desert, Big Mother and Swirl had finally recovered Wen the Dreamer. He stared at the illusion before him and wept. The words, "Shang Xi Tian," mean to go to the western sky, or to ascend to the western heavens. That is, to pass beyond the western border of the Great Wall, to leave this country, to let go of this life, to die and pass away. Zhuli had not been able to wait for him. She had gone ahead to find another beginning. The idea of quiet terrified him. Sparrow wanted to follow her, but even despite the promise of an ending, of freedom, this was the life he couldn't leave behind. In November, Kai left Shanghai and was appointed soloist at the Central Philharmonic in Beijing. The whereabouts of the professor remained unknown, and Sparrow dared not visit the old cat, Ling, or San Li. He had heard that in the middle of a struggle session, the conservatory's resident conductor, Lu Hongwen, had taken a copy of Quotations of Chairman Mao and ripped the book into pieces. A red guard had immediately put a pistol to his face and shot him. Since August, 10 faculty and 8 students had died. The year 1967 arrived, and the conservatory remained closed. Still, Sparrow was summoned to a meeting. The meeting turned out to be solely for him. Yu Hui, the new leader of Sparrow's work unit, had taken over He Luting's office and redecorated it with a dozen posters of Mao Zedong and a half-dozen of Madame Mao in various costumes. Yu, also a composer, had a long face that reminded Sparrow of asparagus. He seemed to take pleasure in telling Sparrow that he was being reassigned to a factory in the southern suburbs.
"May I ask what kind of factory, Comrade Yu?"
"I believe you will be making wooden crates."
Yu Hui stood up from his desk. His face seemed to grow even longer. Sparrow felt the eyes of a dozen Chairman Mao's examining him.
"When will I be transferred?"
"I'm preparing your file as we speak. Be patient. We will inform you in due time."
Will I be allowed to compose again?
Yuhui smiled, as if embarrassed on Sparrow's behalf, that he could ask such a naive question.
You know the saying, the time has come to restring your bow.
He laughed at his own joke.
You're not the only one who must reform and start again. But tell me, is it really true you turned down a position at the Central Philharmonic?
I was not worthy of the offer.
Yuhui smiled once more. He fluttered his hand lazily, dismissing him. Sparrow walked out of the conservatory and onto Fenyang Road. The intensity of the sun bled the street of color, so that the bicycles and occasional trucks seemed to vanish into the white curtain of the horizon. At home, Da Shan had arrived unexpectedly from Zhejiang and was seated at the kitchen table, writing denunciations on long sheets of butcher paper. When Sparrow entered, his brother looked up, brush in his hand, suspended, before looking down and continuing. The most fundamental task of the Cultural Revolution is to eliminate the old ideology and culture, which was fostered by the exploiting class for thousands of years. Counter-revolutionaries like Wen the Dreamer will inevitably distort, resist, attack, and oppose Mao Zedong thought. They appear to be human beings but are beasts at heart. They speak the human language to your face, but behind your back, they... Sparrow retreated to the tiny balcony on the second floor. In the lane, a grandmother was washing her grandchild in a metal tub, and the child cooed happily. The sound lifted Sparrow from his thoughts. He still had 3 cartons of Hataman cigarettes, sent by Kai from Beijing. The cigarettes, so difficult to obtain, were as valuable as a fistful of ration coupons, perhaps more. He smoked one now, reverently. These Hataman afforded him the greatest pleasure of his day. In the kitchen, Ba Lut was rereading Big Mother Knife's most recent letter. "Do you take me for a fool? Tell me what has happened." The envelope contained 2 further letters, addressed to Zhu Li from her parents. So they had found Wen, Ba Lut thought. But was a miracle still a miracle, if it came too late? He took out his lighter, lit the pages, and dropped them into the brazier.
9 lives, 1 death, he said, reciting an old saying, watching the paper curl simultaneously away from and into the flames. 9 lives, 1 death.
Da Shan set his brush down. The poster was already 4 feet long. Looking up the staircase, his eyes met Sparrow's, and the boy's face flickered with emotion. Sparrow recognized grief, fear, remorse. The boy was a teenager and aspired to be an architect, but the red scarf of the young pioneers was knotted firmly around his neck, and ink had roughened his hands. If you want to be an architect, you should go to Tiananmen Square, Sparrow thought. You should see the head, the hands, the feet, the heart, the lungs. You should stand in the middle of the square and listen. Julie's shadow seemed to twist in the stairwell, as if her spirit was tied to his thoughts, and unable to be free. Da Shan waited for Sparrow to say something. Coming home, he had hoped only that his big brother would help him, that Sparrow would not allow him to be sent back to Zhejiang, where, to make up for the impure elements within their family, Da Shan had to take the lead in attacking teachers and other classmates. He had to break them down. Flying Bear had said that Zhu Li must be guilty, because only a criminal would kill herself. Flying Bear had vowed never to go home again.
Only traitors commit suicide.
Thashan said now, staring up at his brother. Smoke lifted away from Sparrow's fingers.
Only the guilty kill themselves. Is that true?
Silence.
Is it true?
Thashan said again. He was infuriated by the softness and the weeping in his voice.
Is it right that she killed herself? If Julie was really a traitor, she deserved everything that happened.
Sparrow came down the steps, and Thashan waited for him to act, to strike him down at last. It was this terrible quiet, Thashan thought, that had come between them, and which he had no idea how to undo. When they were face to face, Sparrow touched his shoulder. There was no weight to his brother's hand. In Zhejiang, make sure you're worthy of the Red Guards. That's your only family now, isn't it? Thashan burst into tears. Infuriated, his words came out as blows.
You're worse than a traitor. Who's protecting you? You did nothing to save Julie. All you care about was your own career.
Sparrow dropped his hand. He looked at Thashan and thought, you used to be so small that I could throw you over my shoulder as if you were a sack of beans. Their father came out of the kitchen.
Enough,
Balut whispered. He was flicking his lighter on and off.
I don't want to hear your cousin's name. Are you listening to me? It's finished, now. Finished.
Thashan ignored his father.
You're a true coward, Sparrow. Maybe Julie was a traitor, but at least she knew who she was. Do you really think you're invisible? Do you think no one can see what you are?
The louder he shouted, the angrier he became.
You were always the most talented one. Everyone said so. But what good is talent if you have nothing inside? They'll come for you next. I promise. No one can save you. I'll make sure of it.
In a daze, Sparrow turned towards the poster Thashan had written. He himself had taught his brother to write his first words, and now he took comfort in the fact that the characters were flimsy, crooked, and nearly unreadable. He turned and walked out of the room, through the front gate, and into the laneway.
My brother, the degenerate!
Thashan had followed him to the laneway and was shouting after him. Watchful faces floated in the windows above, assessing, judging.
Have you no shame?
Sparrow went in the direction of Beijing Road. He had neglected to take his coat, and the wind cut through him. It was a chill wind, out of keeping with the season. Loudspeakers blared, speaking faster and faster. Terrified, his thoughts took on a dreamlike quality, so that every face that he passed looked familiar, a friend, a student he had taught, a child he had known. The loudspeaker repeated its slogans. Long live Chairman Mao.
10,000 years,
Sparrow said. In truth, he wanted to believe. He would not feel so utterly alone if only he could give in and place his trust in a person, or just an idea. Long live our glorious revolution. Long live the people. 10,000 years. Our generation will achieve immortality. At the Shanxi Road intersection, children were throwing bricks at a store that sold women's clothing. Sparrow leaned down and impulsively took up a brick. In his hand, it seemed entirely pure, the weight of a newborn infant. The children were singing a familiar nursery rhyme. The grass in the meadow looks fresh and green, but wait 10 days, not a blade will be seen. The loudspeakers rattled on. There is no middle road. Paint on the walls denounced the occupant as a dissolute and immoral young woman. Lust and desire, which placed private interest over the public good, was a bourgeois luxury and a political crime. A boy swung his arm back. The brick shattered a window on the second floor. Inside the building, a girl was crying. He did not know what room the weeping was coming from. "The degeneracy of your head, your heart, your hands, feet, lungs. Everything was finished." He thought the voice cried out, "I would have loved you for 10,000 years. He stood with the brick in his hands until the boy took it from him. Forcefully, the boy launched it into the air. He sent it crashing through the target's door. Shanghai Wooden Products Factory No. 1 smelled of the earth. Each morning, on waking, Sparrow shook wood dust from his pillow and his hair. In the public bathhouse, dust from his body turned the water orange. He hardly recognized himself. His arms and chest had thickened, reshaped by hours of stacking, lifting, and hammering. Yet for the first time Sparrow could remember, his hands were immune to pain. Calloused, they had grown a thickened coat, a brand new shell. After his shifts, the factory fell away like an extended dream. But when he slept, he still heard the factory's disjointed percussion. Thumping, crashing, and syncopated drumming, dotted with sirens, buzzers, and bells. Not so different from the musique concrète of Varese's Amérique. He couldn't stop hearing this music of the everyday, and its continuity threaded together his former life and his present. One morning, when he had been at the factory for more than a year, Sparrow's work unit was summoned to the meeting hall. Attendance was mandatory, and so, long after the room was full, workers continued to squeeze themselves in. 6 televisions had been set up. Abruptly, a live broadcast began, the first televised struggle session of the Cultural Revolution. An elderly man was dragged onto center stage by a phalanx of Red Guards. To his shock, the Red Guards were known to him. They were former conservatory musicians who had risen to leadership positions. The stage, white with Clegg lights, seemed to shear the television screen in half. Sparrow watched, frozen. Kai stood among a group at the front. He looked sturdier, more self-possessed. At first, Sparrow did not recognize the elderly man, whose head the Red Guards were forcing down so brutally his face could not be seen. A slow pandemonium unfolded. When the elderly man looked up, Sparrow saw that it was He Luting, former president of the Shanghai Conservatory. "Kill the traitor! Kill the traitor!" The chanting in the meeting hall was deafening. Unable to turn or move, he felt as if the lights were being trained on him, growing brighter every moment. Questioning began. It went on and on, but He Luting stubbornly denied his guilt. Yu Hui stepped forward, dressed entirely in olive green as if he had joined the army or a vegetable stand.
"Are you so stupid that you don't understand that you could be killed?" he asked. "Do you think we'll grieve if one more traitor has his head cut off?
Knock him down." "Before I die," He Luting said, "I have 2 wishes. First, I want to finish my current composition, a 7-part orchestral work. Second, I intend to clear each and every charge against me." Unable to respond, the Red Guards took turns striking him.
"I'm not guilty!"
He Luting cried. He looked frail, much older than his age. Another blow from the Red Guards would surely cripple him. He Luting's wife, children, and grandchildren had been gathered on the stage behind him. their heads also pushed down, light reflecting off their hair. Words that He Luting had spoken to him years ago now returned to Sparrow. Music that is immediately understood will not outlast its generation.
"You oppose Chairman Mao,"
Yu said.
"I am not guilty."
"Disgusting traitor. You're nothing but an animal we have to slaughter."
"Your accusations are false. Shame on you for lying."
Around Sparrow in the hall, people stared, bewildered at He Luting's temerity, his stubbornness. On screen, the Red Guards, too, could not believe that this old man, this traitor and counter-revolutionary, this ridiculous musician, could possibly be challenging them. One yanked the microphone away. He Luting reacted quickly, grabbing the microphone back.
"Shame on you!" His voice broke, but he kept going. "Shame on you for lying! Shame on you for lying!"
In an instant, they had twisted his arm so viciously that he fell to the floor. The jeering of the crowd intensified. He Luting was in terrible pain. Kai's face blurred into the screen and out. Amidst the shouted laughter, the Red Guards released him. Sparrow could see that they too wanted to laugh, to swell themselves up again, but He Luting was suddenly on his feet.
"Shame!" he shouted.
The words ricocheted through the speakers.
"Shame on you! Shame on you!"
The room was shocked silent.
"Shame on you for lying!"
His voice was hoarse and broken, but still it cut through. By far the loudest sound emanating from the television.
"Shame!"
The image disappeared. Sparrow waited. The room seemed to tilt away from him, but he was held upright by the pressure of the bodies around him. The live broadcast did not resume. A newsreader appeared on the screen, but the transmission split into gray lines of static. A buzzer sounded, and the workers returned, orderly and subdued, to their positions on the assembly line. Punching in, Sparrow looked at the card reader and was surprised to realize that he had missed his birthday. Yesterday, he had turned 28 years old. 8 months later, Chairman Mao decreed that cities were wasteful and the educated must be sent up to the mountains and down to the villages to experience rural poverty. All universities and middle schools still open would now be closed. All classes not yet canceled were officially over. This new generation would be the heroic Zhiqi, the sent-down youth. In early 1969, Sparrow was summoned by his work unit leader, who informed him that, effective immediately, he was assigned to a factory 1,400 kilometers to the south, in Guangxi province.
"Have you been to the south before?" the cadre asked him.
"I have not."
"You should thank the party. They have given you this opportunity to faithfully serve the people."
"I thank the party and our great helmsman, Chairman Mao."
This time he was not so naive as to ask if he would be allowed to compose once more. 3 days later, at Shanghai Railway Station, hemmed in by a sea of young people, he heard a woman's voice shouting his name. It was Ling. The kindness of her expression and her obvious pleasure at seeing him surprised Sparrow, eliciting an unfamiliar pain. He had been alone for a long time.
"Tell me, where have you been, Sparrow? Have you been in contact with anyone?"
His first instinct was to hide the truth.
"Nowhere. No one."
Kai's in Beijing now. Did you know? He intervened and made sure we were both assigned to the south, and not to the coal mines at the Russian border.
Her voice dropped.
He's done well. He performs regularly for Madame Mao.
When Sparrow didn't answer, she continued.
Kai asked me to look for you. He said you might take a position with the Central Philharmonic.
But I don't write music anymore.
Ling studied him. She looked at him with a familiar intimacy, as if they were still the same people, as if nothing stood between their present and their past. I was a month away from receiving my doctorate, she whispered. And then the announcement came. The university was shut down, and it was over. Why aren't you writing music? Listen, I still remember.
She hummed in his ear so low that no one else could possibly overhear a phrase from Bach's Concerto for Two Violins, and he wanted to put his hand to her lips to quiet and protect her. The day before, Sparrow had posted 3 hastily written letters, one to Big Mother Knife, who was stuck in Yumen City, and had not yet been granted a transfer back to Shanghai. One to Ba Lut, who was interned at a camp in Anhui Province, and one to Kai in Beijing. That night, enforcers from the Shanghai Revolutionary Committee had surprised the neighborhood. They had pulled everyone from their rooms and ordered a renewed search for counter-revolutionary materials. Numbly, he had fed his books and music into the bonfires, even the 3 records given to him by Wen the Dreamer 20 years ago. Sparrow had even burned the papers he had hidden up in the trusses of the roof. His beautiful Symphony No. 2, the still unfinished No. 3. They went into the flames. Nothing remained. He had watched, mesmerized, overcome by a sickening relief, as the albums and the papers, the music and the imagined music, twisted together into a kind of gelatinous mud. All Sparrow carried in his rucksack was a light jacket, 2 changes of clothing, a washcloth, a sleeping mat, a cooking pot, and, because he had promised Zhu Li, the Book of Records. "Have you had any news of the professor?" he asked Ling. She shook her head.
"Even my aunt doesn't know. He was detained and disappeared, and Kai cut all ties with him. You heard what happened to Sunny."
A train was hurtling into the station. "Yes," he said. Sunny had died, jumped from a window, or was pushed. And then, more to himself than to her. "But since no one is responsible, there is no one to forgive."
She spoke directly in his ear. "There is no point in forgiveness. We need to prosper."
He could not imagine what she could possibly mean by the word prosper.
"Kai said we're being sent to a place called Cold Water Ditch," Ling said. "The closest town is Hezhou. I'd never heard of it before."
"Cold Water Ditch," he answered, wishing to make her smile. "The height of prosperity."
"Comrade Sparrow, how would you define prosperity? I believe there is no prosperity but freedom."
The doors of the train cranked open. People crushed forward. Ling gripped his arm so that, in the melee, they would not be separated. The further they traveled from Shanghai, the more he felt as if he was breaking apart. At each station, he whispered, as the older generation might have done, to the ghost of his cousin, "Don't leave, Zhu Li. We have no family in the city anymore. Stay with me."
"She's here, Sparrow," Ling said. "Zhu Li won't leave us."
so that when they arrived, after many days' journey in cold water ditch, it was as if Zhu Li, in some invisible way, had reattached herself to Sparrow's life, to his consciousness and his being. A year later, he and Ling received permission to marry. And a year after that, they had their first and only child, a daughter, Ai Ming. In the spring of 1970, Big Mother Knife finally returned to the Laneway house on Beijing Road. There, she found her entire family missing. Even Mr. and Mrs. Ma were gone. Their oleanders had grown wild, blanketing both wings of the house. She smashed all the crockery. She did it carefully, disposing of her favorites immediately, all the while singing, "Comrades, amputate the branches and tear down the leaves." Her neighbors thought she had lost her mind and backed into their doorways when they saw her coming. By the end, as she was smashing an insipid vase Ba Lut had once given her, despair overwhelmed her. When she crushed it under her shoe, the smallest pieces reminded her of little teeth. "Make revolution," she thought bitterly. "I will make the biggest revolution of them all." In the bedroom, she found a dress of Zhu Li's and one of Ba Lut's straw shoes, and she sat down with them, uncomprehendingly. All the musical instruments and scores were gone. That night, she took the train west to destitute Anhui Province, where Ba Lut had been consigned to a re-education camp. It took 3 days to reach him, and, when she finally did, they wept and argued and fought nonsensically. Ba Lut could not even speak Zhu Li's name. For the last 4 years, he had kept Zhu Li's suicide from her, going so far as to make up stories about her whereabouts and her accomplishments. At this juncture, it is not advised for Zhu Li to write to you. She has been offered the opportunity to study in Paris. Big Mother spat the words back at him. Now Ba Lut told her that he had personally written a letter to Chairman Mao, who could not possibly know all that was being done in his name. Society was in disarray. "You wrote to Chairman Mao? You ridiculous oaf of a man!" "Our own sons denounced me," Ba Lut said, broken. "Da Shan and Flying Bear say they want nothing to do with us. But I have faith that Chairman Mao, our great leader, our saving star, will redeem us." It was and would always be the only thing he ever said that made her weep. "How can he redeem us? Can he turn back time? Can he give a child back her life? You didn't even have the courage to give her a proper burial." "Big Mother, it was impossible. Don't you understand? It was the transformation of the world." "That poor child," she said, turning away. For days, and then months, she thought only of Zhu Li. Swirl and Wen the Dreamer had left Mongolia and crossed into Kyrgyzstan, where they awaited word from their daughter. But Big Mother could not imagine telling them that she was dead, and had been dead since 1966, that she had taken her own life. How could Swirl accept it? Her sister had already lost one child, the little boy who fell from the tram so long ago. Disbelief would push Swirl to come home. She would return to Shanghai at the cost of her life. If Swirl were rearrested, Big Mother could not finish the thought. She could not do it. Back in Shanghai, Big Mother put in a request to be transferred to Sparrow's town, Cold Water Ditch. Finally, after a year of badgering her superiors, deploying gifts, reciting Chairman Mao's most obscure poetry, and confusing everyone with both intimidation and deference, her request was granted. Travel permit and registration papers in hand, she left Shanghai by train. A premonition told her she would never see the city again. By the time the wheel of history tumbled forward and this country awoke once more, she would be stone blind. Annoyed, she glared into the overloaded compartment and cursed every blurry face, every hand, every belly, every cadre, every little red brat. And then, feeling guilty, she closed her eyes and cursed herself. The decrepit train hobbled on, into the humid south. Some little turd had drawn a lopsided egg on the dusty window, or maybe the egg was a zero left behind by someone with bad handwriting. What was a zero anyway? A zero signified nothing. All it did was tell you nothing about nothing. Still, wasn't zero also something meaningful? A number in and of itself. In Tianpu notation, zero indicated a caesura, a pause or rest of indeterminate length. Did time that went uncounted, unrecorded, still qualify as time? If zero was both everything and nothing, did an empty life have exactly the same weight as a full life? Was zero, like the desert, both finite and infinite? Thanks to the painful slowness of the train, she had another 50 hours to think this over. Big Mother sighed and slapped her knee so violently she grunted in pain. None of the other passengers cared. "The silly melon of a train," she shouted. "It stops at every clump of bushes. By the time we get there, you kids will be grandparents and I'll be dead. We're going so slowly, we might as well be going backwards." A murmur of agreement slid down the length of the compartment, easeful and reassuring as the midnight breeze. Part Zero. Music, which is so dear to me, and without which, more than likely, I couldn't live a day. Dmitri Shostakovich. You may say that that is not love, and I would laugh at you for presuming to know what another's love isn't and what his love is. Zia Haider Rahman. In the Light of What We Know. Chapter 7. When Jiang Kai, my father, left China in 1978, one of his suitcases was filled with more than 50 battered notebooks. The notebooks contained drafts of self-criticisms whose final pages must have been submitted years earlier to a superior or an authority figure. Self-criticism, samokritika in Russian, jiantao in Chinese, required that the person confess his or her mistakes, repeat the correct thinking of the party, and acknowledge the authority of the party over him or her. Confession, according to the party, was a form of repentance that would bring the individual back into the collective. Only through genuine contrition and self-criticism could a person who had fallen from grace earn rehabilitation and the hope of resurrection, of being returned to life. I arrived in Shanghai on June 1st, 2016. From my hotel room, I looked down at a city wreathed in mist. Skyscrapers and condominiums shouldered together in every direction, erasing even the horizon. How the city mesmerized me. Shanghai seemed like a library, or even a single book, to hold a universe within itself. My father had arrived here in the late 1950s, a child of the countryside, in the wake of the Great Leap Forward and a man-made famine that took the lives of 36 million people, perhaps more. He had perfected his music, dreamed of both a wider world and a better one, and fallen in love. Day after day, Kai had bent over his desk, feverishly writing and copying pages, revising and reimagining his life and his moral code. We were not unlike, my father and I. We wanted to keep a record. We imagined there were truths waiting for us, about ourselves and those we loved, about the times we lived in, within our reach, if only we had the eyes to see them. Summer fog slowly erased Shanghai from view. I stepped away from the window. I showered, changed, and went down to the subway. Underground, people gazed at screens or tapped at phones, but many drifted, as I did, through their thoughts. Near me, an old woman discreetly savored cake. Phones chimed and honked, a mother and daughter repeated the multiplication table, and a child refused to disembark. Unexpectedly, the train braked. The old woman stumbled, her cake went flying, and she fell into my lap. For a moment, she was suspended in my arms, our faces inches from one another. A big whoop went up from the people around us, followed by jovial applause. A child reprimanded her for eating on the train. Another wanted to know what kind of cake it was. The woman laughed, the sound so unexpected, I nearly dropped her. She was in her late 60s, around the same age Ma would be now. In my imperfect Mandarin, I tried to give her my seat, but the woman waved me off as if I had offered her a ticket to the moon. "Save yourself, child." She said something else, words which sounded like, "Enough crumbs, no? Enough?" "Yes," I said. "Enough." She smiled. The subway hurried on. I could feel my jet lag now. The world around me seemed far away, as if I was carried in a jar of water. A man opened a newspaper so wide it covered his wife and daughter. Behind them, in the windows, their reflections shifted, one behind the other. In his self-criticisms, my father wrote of his love of music and the fear that he could not overcome a desire for personal happiness. He denounced Julie, gave up Sparrow, and cut all ties to the professor, his only family. He wrote of how he had stood by helplessly while first his mother, then his young sisters, and finally his father died. He said he owed his family everything and had a duty to life. For years, Ba tried to abandon music. When I first read his self-criticisms, I glimpsed my father through the many selves he had tried to be. Selves abandoned and reinvented. Selves that wanted to vanish, but couldn't. That's how I see him sometimes, when my anger, on behalf of Ma, Julie, myself, subsides and turns to pity. He knew that leaving these self-criticisms behind would endanger others, yet to destroy them was impossible. So he carried them first to Hong Kong, and then to Canada. Even here, he would begin new notebooks, denouncing himself and his desires. Yet he could not find a way to reinvent himself or change. Last week, preparing for this trip, I came across a detail. In 1949, Tiananmen Square retained its place as the center of political power in China by reason of analytic geometry. An architect, Chen Gang, posited the square as the zero point. He quoted Friedrich Engels,
Zero is a definite point from which measurements are taken along a line. In one direction positively, in the other negatively. Hence, the zero point is the location on which all others are dependent, to which they are all related, and by which they are all determined. Wherever we come upon zero, it represents